Okay. I shrug. I don't know. I was so up yesterday, but I've definitely crashed back to earth today. I snap open the salad lid and sigh. It's nice of the team to want to help, but do you remember how long it took to raise $2,000 for a new discus cage? It was almost 2 years. How are we ever going to raise $20,000? Look, she says, zigzagging dressing across her salad. You are not a discus cage. You are a flesh and blood person who this tragic thing has happened to. People will want to help. She smiles at me. Give them a chance. This should make me feel better, but it doesn't. A dark cloud has formed between me and the dream of running again. A dark cloud called reality. Chapter 9. I have a socket fitting scheduled at Hank's after school. A socket fitting. I don't even really know what that means. I'm quiet on the drive over, and so is Mom. I wonder what's going on with her and Dad and the whole money issue, but I don't ask. I just watch the road ahead. So does she. The exterior of Quality Orthotics and Prosthetics does nothing to lift my mood, but the instant we go inside, Chloe certainly does. Jessica, she says from behind the counter, are you excited? I can't help but smile because she sure seems to be. I guess, I tell her. Well, come on back. He's ready for you. My mom and I exchange looks as we follow Chloe. No Mr. Benson holding us up this time. Chloe leads us to the same room we were in before, and Hank comes in holding a clear plastic version of the cast he took on Tuesday. My name and the date are written right on it in black marker, and along the back are two screws holding the plastic together. He greets us, then has me roll up my pant leg and take off my shrinker sock while he gets a stockingette out of a cupboard. After the stockingette is on, he holds up the plastic cast and says, "So, this is your test socket. What we'll do today is check for pressure points, distribution of weight bearing, and fit. If there's anywhere that hurts, be sure to tell me. It should feel snug and there'll be pressure, but after you get used to that, it shouldn't hurt." He smiles at me. "Ready?" I nod, and he gets down on his knees and slips the socket over my stump. I feel like a freak show Cinderella getting a strange glass slipper put on, but that image vanishes when I realize that the socket feels good. "How's that?" he asks. "Surprisingly comfortable," I tell him. He pushes up on it from the bottom. "How's that?" "Okay," I tell him. He pushes harder. "No pain?" I shake my head. "The clearance here," he says, pointing to the base of the socket, "should be enough so that you don't feel it when the leg is complete and you're standing on it, but not so much that it creates an area where your residual limb can pool with fluids." He nods. "I think we got a good fit here." Next, he has me bend my knee, and he checks all around it, especially in back. The kneecap is exposed and the socket is cut away, so I can flex, but it does pinch a little behind the knee. "Does this need to come down some?" he asks. "I think so." He goes on to check the socket from all angles, making small marks on the plastic as we go over the pressure points. Then he has me stand and lean my short leg on a big block of wood. It's the first time I've stood on both legs since the accident. "How's that?" "Very strange," I tell him. "But is there pain? Excessive pressure? Close your eyes and feel it." "Maybe a little right here," I tell him, pointing to a spot on the inside of my knee. He marks it, and when he's sure there are no other spots, he has me sit down again and slips off the socket. "I think we're set. I should have your leg ready a week from today. It will be a temporary prosthesis, Jessica, because your leg is still changing, but after you're trained on the temporary and your residual limb has had a few months to stabilize, we'll do this again. only with parts that are more suited for your lifestyle. Meaning? He looks at me. You're an active young lady. We want to get you a leg that can keep up with you, but first things first, and that is to get you walking. I'm about to ask him what he knows about running legs, but before I can, my mom says, could I have a word with you about administrative matters? He glances from her to me and catches her drift.
Sure, why don't we talk in my office?
So they leave while I pull my shrinker sock back on and pin my pant leg up. I try not to think about what administrative matters might be because it's clearly about money. I try to block the thought of running from my mind. I try to focus on walking. In 1 week, I'll have a leg. In 1 week, I'll learn to walk again. In 1 week. Chapter 10. It turns out to be a long week. Not because I can't wait to get my leg. I am looking forward to that, but it also scares me a little. What if it's awful? What if I can't figure it out? What if it falls off during school? No, it's a long week because the track team officially invites me to the meet on Thursday, and I'm terrified of going. But how can I not? Already the bake sales and the raffle ticket sales have started. Saturday will be the first Help Jessica Run car wash. On the outside, I'm grateful and happy, but inside, I know it's an impossible goal. They will never raise $20,000. People tell me all the time that I'm still part of the team. They're all excited to be buying me a leg. They're so nice, so positive. They seem to have no idea what a pipe dream this is. When Thursday arrives, I'm still not ready, but it's Liberty versus Langston, our main rival, and it's on our turf. No buses to get on or traveling to do. All I have to do is hobble over to the track. So easy, and yet so hard. I haven't even seen the track since I've been back at school. Not that it's been difficult to avoid. It's out past the gym and the locker rooms, past the basketball courts and the tennis courts and the baseball diamonds. It's the last school structure before empty fields. And it sits on a small rise of land, unprotected from the afternoon winds. Jocks snicker at runners. They think it doesn't take much skill to put one foot in front of the other, that anyone can run track. And I guess people like Merrill Abrams contribute to that. But those of us who are serious about it grin and bear a lot more than players in some real sports. Basketball players wouldn't dream of doing wind sprints in the rain. Tennis players call off practice if the courts are even a little wet. Volleyball players won't have anything to do with the cold. And football players, they chalk talk or pump iron when the weather gets wicked. It's the soccer players and the track team that show all-weather grit. And at Liberty High, the track teams are the only ones of any of the sports to ever win league. And the varsity girls are contenders almost every year. People don't understand why we run. It seems so mindless to them. All you do is go around and around the track. That's the funny thing about running, the deceptive thing about it. It may seem mindless, but it's really largely mental. If the mind's not strong, the body acts weak, even if it's not. If the mind says it's too cold or too rainy or too windy to run, the body will be more than happy to agree. If the mind says it would be better to rest or recover or cut practice, the body will be glad to oblige. My mother says I was born a runner, that I entered this world wanting to get up and go. Kaylee, on the other hand, has always hated running, not because I love it, but simply because she hates it. She tried it a couple of summers ago, but after a week of easy jogs with me, she asked, "When do you stop counting your steps?" I didn't know how to answer that. I'd never counted steps in my life. So maybe it's something you're born with, or maybe it's something you adopt. I just know that for me, running was like eating and breathing. It was something I had always done, and without it, I felt miserable, suffocated. Losing a leg was like having to learn to suck in air through the pores of my skin, Somehow I survived, but each breath was painful. And then Cairo showed me the footage of amputees running, and running fast. Air seemed to fill my lungs again. I was heady and happy, and I could feel myself, a future me, running. I want to hold on to that. I want to believe. But $20,000 of reality has sunk in, and my lungs have shut down again. I feel like I'm trapped under a layer of ice, holding on to what little air I have, drowning under a cold, hard ceiling that's keeping me from something that can save me. Chapter 11. After school, Chandel Norwood catches me teetering with uncertainty near the tennis courts. "Hey, girl!" she calls and zips over. "Why are you standing out here?" I shrug. "I was going to go to the meet to cheer you guys on, but..." My voice trails off, so she finishes for me. "But you're not sure you can handle it?" Her words come out gentle, like she totally gets it. My throat closes down and my eyes fill up. "Oh, girl," she says, putting her arms around me. "We're going to get you running again. You know that?" I shrug. "Look, if you can't handle coming to the meet, don't come. Everyone will understand." "But it's Langston." She understands this, too. Langston's got state-of-the-art everything, from their starting blocks to their jumping standards to their landing systems and cages and hurdles and bleachers. Their equipment totally puts Liberty High to shame. It's their track, though, that has us all green with envy. Ours is dirt. Theirs is a tartan track. It's the most amazing track I've ever run on. It's clean, smooth, and fast, and it's a beautiful royal blue. Whenever I race at Langston, I imagine that I'm running across water. It's an incredible feeling. So Langston is our big league rival, and even though they have everything our team would love to have, we have the one thing a team can't buy. Spirit. Maybe it's a bond formed from years of running into the wind. Maybe it's because Cairo calls us his family and expects us to treat one another that way. Maybe it's just the fight of the underdog. Whatever it is, we have it, and Langston doesn't. Oh, they act like they do, but you can feel it. It's just a show. Chandel studies me, and very slyly she says, "Yeah, that Vanessa Steele's gonna be prancing all over the place like she's unbeatable or something. Like you never even existed." Blood prickles through my body. Vanessa Steele. She refused to shake my hand after I beat her at the Westfield Invitational. She's probably relieved that I've been knocked out of the competition. I clench my crutches and start in the direction of the track. "Let's go," I tell Chandel.
"That a girl," she says,
and falls into step beside me. We talk about her events, and I kid her a little about her discus release. Then, when we're near the track, I stop for a moment and soak in the view. The starter's already there and easy to spot in his red hat and coat, and the Langston teams are trudging through a warm-up lap. Our teams are scattered, warming up in groups, helping Cairo deliver things to the various officials and field judges. There's JV girls, JV boys, varsity girls, varsity boys. Four teams from each school is a lot to coordinate.
"There it is," Chandel says with mock reverence. "The oval of pain."
I laugh and tell her, "Go on, you've got to warm up. Stretch out, bring home some fives."
"I don't know about that," she says. "But if I get a third and we win by one, I'm taking credit for the whole shooting match."
"You do that," I laugh. She takes off, and I swing forward toward the field. I want to wish my team good luck. And I want to stand among them and somehow believe that I still belong. Chapter 12. I join the pre-meet Liberty huddle, then stay infield to cheer on runners in the 4x100 meter relays and the 1600 meter runs. The heats go fast, JV girls, JV boys, varsity girls, varsity boys, but each race is still a long process. When the varsity girls line up for the 1600, I head over to Rigor Mortis Bend and shout my heart out for Fiona each time she goes by. She's ahead at the 800-meter mark, but I can see her tighten up during the third lap. She holds on for as long as she can, but at 1,400 meters, she loses her lead and has to fight with everything she's got to stay in second place. She does get second, though, which brings in 3 points for the team, but she is not happy. "That's 6 seconds slower than my PR," she says, gasping for air when we meet up. "That third lap killed me. I just never recovered." I give her a pep talk and a hug, and after she's caught her breath, she mutters, "Time to play nice with the manipulator," and wanders off to the high jump pit. I don't tag along. I'm feeling kind of worn out, and I'm really not in the mood to make phony chit-chat with Meryl Abrams, especially since it's pretty hard not to notice that Gavin's over there with her. So when Cairo and some parent helpers start setting up hurdles, I take the opportunity to crutch across the track to the bleachers. Liberty High's track has only one set of bleachers. It's got steps up the middle, which divide it into two sections, one for home, one for away. Nobody pays attention to that, though. Even with our standing in league, usually the only people who show up at track meets are dedicated parents, plus the occasional boyfriend or girlfriend. It's not like there are squads of cheering voices. Besides, it's way more important to find a group to huddle with to help body block the rising winds, and some afternoons anyone will do. As I hobble across the track, I feel like I'm getting stares from people in the bleachers. I can see parents whispering to each other about me. Or maybe I'm imagining it. Maybe they're not noticing me at all. I go up the entrance steps, take a seat on the bottom bench, lay my crutches down, and unload my backpack. Then I sit through the 100-meter hurdles for the girls and the 110-meter high hurdles for the boys. There are legs. Legs. Everywhere. I watch them move so effortlessly. Pair after pair of perfectly tuned, beautifully timed legs. How could I have never seen them this way before? In between the races, I watch the high jump pit out in the distance. Gavin's still there. I feel my heartbeat grow faster inside my chest. I try to calm it, but it pounds maddeningly harder. Pretty soon my breathing turns shallow, and then there's the familiar flutter of butterflies in my stomach. This has nothing to do with Gavin Vance. It has everything to do with the hurdles being cleared. The 400 meter is next. Starting blocks are adjusted, and soon the JV girls shake out and get into position. I grip the rail in front of me as the starter calls, "To your mark, set." Then the starting gun cracks and my heart gallops away. I want to cheer for the girls. I want to dash to the infield and root them around Rigor Mortis Bend. But all I can do is death grip the rail and fight back the lump in my throat. This is not my heat, but this is my race. My race. There's a soft voice beside me. "Jessica?" I turn and see a woman I don't know sitting beside me. Oh, wait. She is a little familiar. My mind scrambles to remember. She's not one of our runner's moms. She's actually too well put together for any kind of track mom. Her hair is long and sleek with subtle highlights. Her hands are perfectly manicured, but mostly it's her clothes. They're classy. Nothing sweats-like about them. Who is she? "I'm Claudia Steele," she says softly, "Vanessa's mom." She has her hand out, so I shake it, but I'm stunned. "I just want to say how sorry I am," she begins. I move to pull my hand away, but she holds it. "I don't know the right words to use," she continues. "I don't know if there are right words. In her eyes, I see sincerity. My hand stops pulling. Thanks, I tell her, and for a moment I forget that there's a race going on. She does finally let go of my hand, but she doesn't leave. Through the JV boys' race, neither of us says a word. And it's odd to sit through the girls' varsity lineup with her beside me. I wish her away. Her being there is making me terribly uncomfortable, but she just sits there, silently watching as Vanessa adjusts her trademark racing glasses, rolls her shoulders and neck, shakes at her legs, and finally gets down in the blocks. This has to be very hard on you, Mrs. Steele says. I keep my eyes fixed on the runners. Please, I think, just go away. But then out of my mouth slips, this is my first time back. I could kick myself. Why am I talking to her if I want her to go away? The gun goes off and Vanessa shoots from the blocks. She gathers speed and her stride lengthens. Her legs are long, fluid, beautiful. I close my eyes and try to stop my chin from quivering. What made me think I could do this? Vanessa wins the race easily, which gives Langston 5 points, but we get 3 for second and 1 for third, so Langston nets only 1 point. Still, it's hard to take, especially with my rival's mother sitting beside me. I'm just thinking of an excuse to leave, since she's not, when Vanessa comes clomping up the steps. She's still wearing her racing glasses. This track is a joke, she spits out. This whole place is a joke. My time was terrible. I have an urge to flatten her. She's made her mother uncomfortable, too, and I can tell Mrs. Steele wants to say something to her daughter, but before she can, Vanessa holds out a hand. Can I see my phone? Her mother produces it from her purse, and as she's handing it over, she says, You recognize Jessica Carlisle, don't you? Yeah, hey, she says to me, checking for texts. She hands the phone back to her mother, then turns and walks away. Vanessa, her mother calls. But Vanessa says, I've got to get a rub down before the hurdles. Vanessa, her mother snaps. But she doesn't even get acknowledged this time. Excuse my daughter, Mrs. Steele says after a moment. Her hands are shaking as she refastens her purse. And when it's closed, she faces me and says, No, excuse me for raising such a self-absorbed daughter. Then she stands and walks away, leaving me the same way she found me. Stunned. Chapter 13. After I get over my shock, I can only think of one thing to do. Tell Fiona. I wait until the next race is over, then crutch across the track and make my way toward the high jump area. Before I can reach it, Gavin intercepts me. It's great to see you out here, he says. It's the first time I've seen him at any meet ever, so I tell him, It's great to see you out here too, but with limited enthusiasm. I nod over at Merrill, who's a few yards away pulling on her sweats. How'd she do? He glances over his shoulder at her. She tried her best. I hold back a snicker because he seems to really mean it. Merrill's best is about 4'6" and involves a lot of drama. And since high jump is her only event, she's always finding some excuse to leave after she's eliminated. So you're taking off? I ask. Are you kidding? This is Langston. We're the underdogs. We need to win this thing. I give him a curious look. Wow, Gavin, I had no idea you were so into track. He laughs. It's sort of contagious, isn't it? There's a sweetness to the blush of his cheeks that I try very hard to ignore. You ever thought about running? He shrugs. I used to be fast in elementary school, but that was a long time ago, and I don't exactly come from a family of sports people. I eye him. You can be a politician and run, you know, and I'm not talking about for office. He laughs again, then gives his chin scruff a thoughtful scratch.
That's a whole new paradigm, isn't it?
Meryl is suddenly upon us. Hey, Jess, she says, then turns to Gavin. I have a killer headache. I really need to get home. This creates an awkward moment, so I tell them both, see ya, and hobble over in time to see Fiona's approach. The bar's at 4'10", and she flips over it with ease.
Nice, I tell her when she comes back around.
They have to cycle through all the remaining jumpers before it's Fiona's turn again, so I've got time to tell her what happened.
Guess who sat next to me during the 400?
Who?
Vanessa Steele's mother.
No,
she blinks at me.
On purpose?
So I tell her the story from beginning to end, and when I'm done, she gasps.
Unbelievable! The whole thing is unbelievable!
Bartlett, the pit judge calls. Bartlett, you're up!
Gotta go, Fiona says. She takes her mark, composes herself, rocks back and forth a few times, then approaches the bar and flips right over it. She returns to me, breathless.
I am so pumped right now, she laughs. Everyone will be when they hear about it.
I grab her arm.
Wait, no,
you can't tell other people.
Why not?
She asks, incredulous.
Because
I try to sort things out quickly in my mind, but I don't really know why. It just feels wrong. Because her mom was really nice.
So?
So I think it's, you know, bad karma. She squints at me.
Bad karma? Vanessa Steele is what's bad karma.
Look, just don't, okay? She sighs.
Whatever you say.
Then she gets fiery again.
But I'm gonna yell my lungs out for Annie and Giselda and the 300 hurdles.
I'll yell with you, I say with a laugh, because we always cheer for them. Annie and Giselda are fun and funny and awesome hurdlers. They're just not as good as Vanessa. Chapter 14. It's down to two varsity girl high jumpers, Fiona and a Langston jumper named Yossi, when the hurdles are set up again for the 300-meter race. The finish line is very near the high jump area, which is pretty convenient for us, but it's doing nothing for Fiona's concentration. She already missed one pass at 5'2" when the JV girls were hurdling, and when we see varsity lineup, she decides she doesn't want to risk missing again.
I'll be back in a minute,
she tells the pit judge, after Yossi has a second miss.
Wait, the judge says. Can't you finish your jumps?
Give me 2 minutes,
she begs. And when he nods, we hurry toward the 200-meter mark as fast as I can. Across the field, Vanessa is making a show of getting into her blocks, running through her psych-out routine. I try telepathing my mantra over to Annie and Giselda.
Smooth, strong, fast. Smooth, strong, fast. I think it hard, trying to cancel Vanessa's psych out. The gun goes off, and the girls shoot forward, finding their stride, leaping over the first hurdle, regaining their stride, leaping over the second hurdle. It makes no sense to cheer from so far away, so instead Fiona grumbles,
who does she think she is, always wearing those glasses?
Come on, Annie, I'm starting to call. Annie's still too far away to hear me, but I can't help it.
Come on, Annie!
They round the bend, and Vanessa's lead is becoming clear. She's in lane two, with Annie on her right shoulder and Giselda on her left.
Catch her! Annie, you can do it!
I shout, and I find myself hopping up and down on my leg. The sound of their pounding is getting louder, like a stampede.
Go, Annie! I shout. You can catch her!
And then, only a few yards away from us, the unthinkable happens. Vanessa's foot catches on her hurdle. Suddenly, she's flailing through the air. The hurdle crashes forward, and although it almost takes Annie out, somehow Annie maneuvers around it and stays in her lane.
Giselda nearly wipes out, avoiding Vanessa, but she manages to stay in her lane, too. In the time it takes to gasp, the race is over, and to everyone's shock, Liberty has swept the event. Vanessa is back on her feet, and she is furious.
Well, I guess she's okay, Fiona says with a snort. Man, listen to her.
Wouldn't want her to be mad at me, I laugh. And we join our winning girls in pogoing around.
Bartlett!
The pit judge hollers. Fiona zips back to the high jump and wins the event by clearing 5'3", and she is so psyched by everything that's happening that she has the bar raised to 5'4½" and sets a new PR. Then Cairo appears, and although he's congratulatory toward Fiona, I can tell that something's wrong. What's going on? I ask him. His lips pinch together for a moment, and then he says,
Langston has lodged a complaint with the Red Hat. Vanessa Steele believes that you were planted on the sidelines to distract her.
This takes a minute to sink in. What? I ask. What? Fiona asks. What? Everyone around us demands. Cairo lets out a heavy sigh.
I know, but I need to ask. What were you shouting from the sidelines?
What was I shouting? I give him an incredulous look. I don't know. Go, Annie, go? Something like that?
You weren't yelling at her? He asks.
No. I look to Fiona for support, and she jumps in with, absolutely not! She was rooting for Annie. Cairo takes a deep breath.
Okay, then. The Red Hat called it a ridiculous charge, but I want to set the record straight regardless. I'll have a talk with him and the coach.
Do you want me to come? I ask. He hesitates, then says,
You know, that might be a good idea.
So I crutch across the field. And in the meeting with the starter and Langston's coach, I explain that I was just rooting for my team like everyone else does. While I'm talking, I can see Vanessa in the background pacing back and forth. Her mother is trying to talk to her, but Vanessa is obviously more interested in watching us than listening to her. Finally, I say, Look, can you just call Vanessa over? I'll apologize, even though I really don't see how her clipping a hurdle was my fault. The Langston coach waves Vanessa over, and with her mother's nudging, she joins us. She's still got her sunglasses on, so it's hard to make eye contact with her, but I look straight at the lenses and say, Hey, Vanessa, I was just cheering on my own team. I'm sorry if I was a distraction to you. She doesn't say a thing. I give a little shrug and chuckle, and I try to make light of it. I guess I'm probably a distraction to everybody, huh? A heartbeat passes. That's all. Then she turns to the starter and says, So why is she here? If she knows she's a distraction to everyone, why is she here? I feel my body flush hot. Cairo steps forward.
Because she's still part of our team, that's why.
It's obvious that Vanessa is thinking, oh, right. And that's when it sinks in. I'm not really part of the team. Not anymore. My eyes burn as I hurry away. It was a nice fantasy, but that's all it was. Chapter 15. I'm still in a complete funk the next day and in no mood for icy Ms. Rucker. Jessica, she says after the tardy bell rings, when are you planning to return to your regular seat? It's true that I'm moving around on my crutches much better than I used to. It's true that the reason she sat me back with Rosa was because I was in a wheelchair. It's true that other people with crutches just sit in their regular seats. And I am getting my leg today. But days ago, I decided I'm staying at Rosa's table.
Even when I'm walking again, I'm staying. I'm not, I tell her. And I'm surprised by the sound of my own voice. It's confident, with a twinge of defiance. Ms. Rucker holds my gaze. I think it might be better for Rosa if you took your assigned seat.
No,
Rosa says, and everyone turns to look at her.
I like her here,
Rosa says in her underwatery tones. Please? Miss Rucker frowns, then looks from me to Rosa and back again.
Then the note writing has got to stop.
I look at Rosa. Rosa looks at me. Our faces both say, oops. Fine, I say to Ms. Rucker. But she's just been helping me keep up. Rosa's a math genius, you know. Ms. Rucker studies me.
Yes, I'm aware of that,
she says, and decides not to argue with me about the content of our notes, even though she knows I'm fibbing.
Math lab would be a more constructive option, she says with one eyebrow arched high.
Then she begins writing on the board. Rosa immediately slips me a note.
Thanks.
I smile at her. And for the first time since the track meet, I smile inside, too. Chapter 16. Mom notices how quiet I am as she drives me to Hank's.
Are you okay?
I nod, but say, I don't understand how this fake leg is going to work. What if I can't make it work?
You'll figure it out, sweetheart. Remember Chloe, okay?
We couldn't even tell. That does help. And Chloe's her usual bubbly self when she sees us, which helps too.
Today's the day, she says, as we check in. Did you bring shorts and your right shoe?
I nod and hold them up.
Can I change? We came straight from school.
She leads me to a small bathroom, and on the way she says,
It'll feel weird at first, but don't be discouraged. I know you'll get the hang of it fast, and once you do, you'll be walking everywhere.
She says it quietly, conspiratorially, like she's sharing a secret. Like we're friends. She takes my right running shoe from me.
You'll definitely use a cane or a crutch at first, but you'll get rid of that in no time, too.
Thanks, I tell her, and I'm grateful to hear this from someone who knows. Someone I believe. After I've changed into shorts, Chloe waves me down to a room with mirrored walls and long parallel bars. The bars are at about hip height and maybe 3 feet apart. It looks remotely like a dance studio, only instead of tutus, there are miscellaneous fake body parts here and there, and the only dancers are Hank and my mother. Their conversation stops immediately when I walk in. Hank picks up a fake leg from against the wall and smiles at me.
Time to get you walking again.
It looks like a mannequin's foot with a metal pipe sticking out of it. The pipe is about 8 inches long and 1.5 inches in diameter with 2 metal connectors, one down by the foot and one up where the pipe attaches to the socket. The connectors have little holes and divots in them and look like strange plumbing couplings, like something my dad might use under a sink. On top of the pole is the finished socket. It's skin-colored and is cut away at the knee, so it looks like a kind of stirrup for my leg. He grins at me as I soak it all in.
Yes, it's a little Hankensteinish, but my focus snaps to my mom.
You told him?
She looks chagrined, but he says,
I laughed my head off, Jessica. I might even change the name of my business to Hankensteins, but unfortunately, most of my clients aren't in the frame of mind for such humor.
He eyes me.
It's a really good sign that you are.
I'm still embarrassed, but I nod and say, so, what do I do? He has me take off my left shoe and sit in a chair that's right by the parallel bars.
Then he hands me a tube-shaped nylon to put over my stump and has me put a stump sock on over the nylon. It's like a regular sock, only with no heel, shape, or seam. It's also softer and stretchier than a regular sock.
"Now for the liner," he says,
and pulls a white, foamy-looking thing out of the socket of my fake leg. He hands over the liner and says,
"Just slip this on and tell me how it feels."
"Is it supposed to be snug?" I ask. "It feels a little loose." He takes it off and has me put on a thicker ply sock, then put the liner on again. This time it seems to fit better. So he holds the fake leg so that the open end of the socket is facing my stump and says,
"Just put your leg inside."
I do, and it's a snug, comfortable fit. But it's very strange to look down and see a pipe leg and a fake foot attached to me. "How does it stay on?" I ask, because it sure doesn't seem like I could actually walk with it.
"We'll get to that in a minute. First, I want to check the fit."
He pushes and twists the socket, and when he's sure it's okay, he pulls the leg off and says,
"We're going to use a suspension sleeve to hold the leg in place."
He picks up a tan, rubbery-looking sleeve and starts pulling it onto the outside of the socket.
"This is a neoprene material, like what wetsuits are made of. The sleeve will create a vacuum between you and your prosthetic leg that will hold it firmly in place."
He doubles the sleeve back over the socket, then holds the leg out for me.
"If I can get you to slip your leg in?"
So I do. And then he has me pull the double-backed part of the sleeve up over my leg. It's like a big, rubbery sock that ends about mid-thigh and seems to suck the fake leg on tight.
"Ready to stand?"
he asks.
"I guess so," I answer.
But then I just sit there, frozen in place.
"Use the bars if you want to. Just stand like you remember doing."
It's strange. It's like my brain doesn't quite remember what it used to do. I've been hopping and crutching for so long, getting up and down differently, I'm almost afraid to try. So I grab the bars and I use my left leg to power myself up.
"Put weight on it,"
he encourages me.
"It shouldn't hurt."
But I'm not so much afraid of the pain as I am of not being able to work this pipe leg. I get a rush of panic. How is this ever going to work? How am I ever going to be able to walk on this thing? Slowly, I put weight on my right leg. It takes a minute for my leg to settle in, and when it does, I feel lopsided, like my fake leg is way too long.
"Is your weight distributed evenly?"
Hank asks. When I nod, he says,
"I'm going to check the height now,"
and puts his thumbs on the crest points of my hip bones. "The leg feels way too long," I tell him. He nods, knowingly.
"That's normal. You've had no resistance or pressure on that leg for quite some time now, so even when it's perfect, patients still say it feels long."
He smiles at me.
"But in this case, it is long."
He takes a thin wooden block and slips it under my good foot, then checks my hip bones again.
"By raising the left side," he says, "I'll know how much I have to shorten the pylon."
After a minute of assessing how level I am, he takes another, thinner block and slips it under my left foot so that it's on top of the first block.
"Very good," he says after checking the level again. "The first block was half an inch, the second one a quarter inch, which means we've got to take the pylon down 3/4 of an inch.
He has me sit down and uses an Allen wrench to loosen the top coupling. Then he removes the pipe from the socket. The foot is still attached to the bottom end of the pipe, and having him do this feels strange, like I'm some sort of doll where the parts snap on and off. He leaves the room with the pipe and foot, and before long, he's back.
"Let's try this,"
he says, and reattaches the pipe to the socket.
I stand up again, and even though the leg still feels long, he checks the level and says,
"Perfect."
"Are you sure?" I ask.
"I am. Don't worry. That feeling of it being too long will go away."
Then he says,
"Now, what I want you to do is hold on to the bars and just rock back and forth on one foot, then the other."
I do this, and what's so surreal is that I can feel my foot. It's not there. I know it's not there. But as I'm rocking back and forth, my brain seems to be sighing with relief. "Oh, there it is."
"How's that?" Hank asks.
"Is it supposed to feel like my foot is there?" I ask quietly.
"Does it?"
he asks in return. I nod, then I look at him. He's smiling.
"It's not the case for everyone, that's for sure, but I find that the patients who have that sensation adapt much more quickly than those who don't."
"But why does it feel that way?"
"Your brain is still wired to your having a foot."
He shrugs.
"Body's nerves send signals, and the brain adapts or reacts. That can be a phantom pain or simply feeling like a limb is still there. It's not entirely understood, but if your brain thinks your prosthetic foot is your real foot, that's a very good sign."
I glance at my mother, and she's looking a little tense, but also pleased.
"All right," Hank says. "Now I want you to put your left foot forward, then pull it back. Put your right foot forward, pull it back. Don't go anywhere, just do a little hokey-pokey for me."
So I do. And each time I put my right leg out and back, I feel a little more confident.
"Let's try a few steps," he says, when I've hokey-pokeyed enough. "Hold on to the rails and move forward. The biggest obstacle is fear, and you have no reason to be afraid. Just do what your body remembers."
And so I take my first step, and my second step, and my third. The fake leg feels snug, solid. I can't roll off the foot like I can with my regular leg, but I move forward step by step until suddenly I'm at the end of the bars. I look up and see my reflection in the mirror. My new leg is not a pretty sight, but it doesn't freak me out. I turn around, and there's my mother and Hank standing at the opposite end. My mother has a look on her face that's hard to define. Hope, anticipation, worry. I feel like I'm her baby again, taking my first wobbly steps. I take a deep breath, then loosen my grip on the bars. Two steps forward. My hands are hovering above the bars. I take two more steps, and two more. Tears sting my eyes. I'm walking. Chapter 17. It's almost another hour of adjustments and testing and warnings about not overdoing it, watching for hot spots, and avoiding stump blisters at all costs before I walk out of there. But I do walk out of there. Hank has given me a cane, so I use it for stability, and although I'm not entirely confident or even very competent, I want to walk. And Hank tells me that's 90% of the battle won. On the way home, Mom has the brilliant idea that what I need are some of those warm-up pants with zippers that run all the way up the sides of the legs. So we drive downtown to the sports stop, and since I'm still in my shorts, I have her go in without me. She returns with two pairs. One's royal blue and gold, Liberty colors, and the other is black with white trim. "They're perfect," I tell her. And she seems happy. Really happy. Dad's happy to see me moving on both legs, too, but he's also fascinated by the leg itself.
He wants to hear all about the fitting and the adjustments and how the suction sleeve works, and when he's up to speed on all the mechanics of it, he makes me walk across the kitchen about 6 times. I think for the first time in ages, he sees hope. Kaylee's like, "Wow, you're gonna have so much fun on Halloween." And I give her a friendly punch in the arm for that. And when Fiona hears I'm home and walking, she drops everything and rushes over to the house. "I'll get it," I call when the doorbell rings. I've switched into my new warm-up pants, so when Fiona takes me in, all she sees is me in my Nikes. Exactly how I used to look. I step back and say, "Come on in." I try hard to make my gait even as we walk down the hallway. Hank says it's the one thing that gives you away, but that by paying close attention and watching yourself in a mirror, you can master an even gait. There are no mirrors, so I can't see how I'm doing, but Fiona has a definite opinion. "That's amazing," she says, following me into the kitchen. "She's showing off," my mom scolds. "She's supposed to be carrying a cane." "Wow," Fiona says, watching me. "Wow, wow, wow." Then I sit down and unzip my pant leg, and her face falls. "It's just a pipe? Aren't they going to, you know, make it look like a leg?" I shrug. "This one's temporary, and I have to go in every week for adjustments, so it's just a lot more practical to have it like this." "So when do you get your permanent leg?" "It depends. Hank thinks I'll be ready in 2 or 3 months. They want to make sure my leg's all done changing." I zip down my pant leg and smile at her. "In the meantime, it's good to be walking around." "Hey," she says, getting all excited. "You have got to show up at the car wash tomorrow walking. Cairo will be floored. And the car wash is going to be great. Cairo has this huge blue and gold banner made. It says, 'Help Jessica run.' And the car wash committee voted to wear track uniforms, so we'll be color coordinated with the sign." I laugh. "You want to be color coordinated with a sign?" She scowls at me. "It'll make us more visible and show that we're a team working towards something." "Wait, I thought you were on the bake sale committee." She grins. "Come on, I'm on all the committees." I laugh. "Figures. So you'll come?" How could I not? I hug her and tell her I'll be there. Chapter 18. It's amazing how 2 thin pieces of clothing can hold such deep memories. Laughter, pain, victory, defeat, friendship, fatigue, elation. They're all there, but only to the person who's worn the uniform. To the rest of the world, it's simply shorts and a tank top. Fiona told me to wear them to the car wash, but holding the gold shorts and Liberty singlet now makes me feel like an imposter. Still, I finally take a deep breath and pull them on. The fabric is cool and smooth against my skin. Memories tingle through me. I sit on the edge of my bed for a long time, fighting back tears. Why am I wearing a track uniform? What am I thinking? Each of yesterday's steps was careful, calculated, conscious. I can't see them ever being anything but, and that's just walking. Then I remember Chloe and the YouTube athletes. They make movement, running, look so natural, so easy. How do they do that? I finally put on my leg and pull on my new blue and gold side zip sweats. I feel better covered up, like less of an imposter. Going downstairs, I navigate the steps carefully. I feel clunky and clumsy and slow, and I'm glad for the handrail. I actually think about sitting and scooting, but I do make it down without cheating. I find my parents in the kitchen. "So, who wants to drive me to the car wash?" I ask, putting on a brave face. "Or can I just drive myself?"
I'm joking, but Dad takes me seriously.
I'll drive you,
he says quickly. And before long, we're on our way to the gas station on the corner of Grand and Highland.
The first thing I see is the banner. Help Jessica run.
The colors are bright, and it's way bigger than I imagined. And it's strange to see my name up there. Like, it must be another Jessica, not me. There are blue and yellow balloons punching around in the wind, and two bake sale tables set up with blue and yellow tablecloths, and about 25 or 30 people in blue and gold track uniforms. Some of the runners are washing cars, some are working the bake sale tables, and some are holding poster board signs and shouting at cars from the corner.
Wow,
my dad says when he sees the setup.
How lucky am I, huh?
He gives me a curious look, but then nods as he turns into the parking lot.
Luckier than I knew.
He pulls to a stop and asks,
Is this good?
Great.
You need help?
I open the van door and carefully step down.
Nope,
I say from the ground. Then I grab my cane, blow him a kiss, and close the door. Chapter 19. I get mobbed by my teammates, and of course they all want to see the leg. Until they do. The girls try not to show it, but they are horrified.
Oh my God, it's just a pipe. Aren't they going to make it look, you know, real?
The guys, though, think it's wicked cool.
That is tight, man.
Yes, dude, come here, check out Jessica's leg.
Wow, that is crazy. That's like Terminator tough.
I tell myself that the guys being wowed and the girls being revolted is better than the other way around, but both extremes are a little much. Cairo intervenes.
Hey, people, get back to your posts. We're trying to make some money here.
Everyone but Fiona scatters, and he smiles at me and says,
It's great to see you out here, and it's great to see you in uniform.
Her idea, I say, hitching a thumb at Fiona.
Well, it's a good one.
I zip down my pant leg and say, It's not pretty, I know, but it's nice to be able to walk again.
I'll bet it is, he says with a laugh. And it is the first step to running again.
He looks around.
Good turnout, huh?
I nod. Even Merrill is there, working the bake sale table. But after a while, it becomes clear that the turnout is really mostly people from the track team and their parents. I help out at the different tables and talk to people, but after being there almost an hour, I'm getting the picture that there's not enough work to go around. Then I hear,
Hey, Jessica!
From across the lot.
Yeah?
I call back.
Get over here!
It's Graham DeBlau and Mario Reed. Graham's a vaulter and Mario's a sprinter. Right now they're both waivers flagging me out to the sidewalk. So Fiona and I make our way over to them.
You're wearing shorts, right?
Graham asks. I nod.
So take off those sweats and stand here with us.
Mario adds,
A lot more people will stop.
I blink at them.
No way. I'd be like a freak show.
Look, Graham says, How are people supposed to understand what we're doing? How are they supposed to know who Jessica is?
Yeah,
Mario chimes in.
Maybe the bus wreck was in the news, but people forget.
I look at Fiona for help, but she just shrugs and says, I totally get why you wouldn't want to, but it would explain more than any sign, that's for sure. Two other runners have been listening in, Colin Johnson and Melanie Matta. Colin says,
You should also hold a sign that says, I'm Jessica.
No,
I snap.
How about one that says, Help me run, Melanie suggests.
I cringe. I would feel like a beggar.
Look, Graham says, you need to help us out here.
What they're saying is true. I know it is. But standing on the street with my pipe leg and a sign? It would be so embarrassing. So icky. Still, they're all doing this for me. Shouldn't I be helping out the